Welcome back to the Zero Pressure podcast series, a relaxed conversation with those on the cutting edge of science and technology, hosted by me, Helen Sharman, and presented by Imperial College London and Saab. The Zero Pressure podcast series is looking at how science and technology positively can contribute to solving complex, interrelated global challenges of today and tomorrow. This time, we're delving into the world of material science. In the English-speaking world, the word material is often confused with cloth, but in the context of material science and this podcast, we mean any physical substance. And as one set of chemical elements can be combined in multiple ways to produce quite different materials, I mean, think about diamond and graphite, both made from just carbon, but with different arrangements of the atoms giving the materials different properties. I mean, there's a huge number of possible new materials yet to be made. New materials and processes to make them, from printed electronics to biological hybrids, are driving innovation throughout electronics and beyond. How can new materials affect the way we work towards sustainability? And what role is biology playing in the development of new materials themselves? My guest today on Zero Pressure is Professor Magnus Barregrim. Magnus is a professor in organic electronics at Linköping University and an elected member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. He's one of the pioneers of printed electronics, organic bioelectronics, and electronic plants. Magnus is also director of the Wollenberg Initiative Material Science for Sustainability Programme, enabling sustainable technologies with impact on our society by understanding, creating, and controlling complex materials, sometimes with single-atom precision. Magnus says, "I see functional materials as the most important component in the development of green energy technology and in making circular solutions possible." Welcome to Zero Pressure, Magnus, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Helena. Looking forward to the discussion today. I'm very happy and honored to be here.
Tell me, what inspired you to become a material scientist?
All since I was a small boy, I have always liked to construct things, to build things, and gradually I turned my interest into materials and found it extremely interesting what you actually can construct from, all the way from atoms up to very advanced devices. So I have loved to work with devices both on my spare time and also professionally. So this is taking everything from a material and all the way to a device that can execute and do, in the beginning, fun things, but more gradually over the years, important things, maybe as a device in medicine or in also in energy technology. So that is my inspiration.
What are the motivations in your field for designing and using the new materials that you're interested in?
I mean, I would say it's two pathways. One pathway is that we can do things that has never been done before. And my engineering brain, when I look at material science, is that I would like to solve engineering challenges and generate new opportunities by designing the functions already at the level of materials rather than very complex devices. So that is, so for instance, can I translate an electronic signal into the delivery of a neurotransmitter? How is that done? And then we need to go down to the material. So that gives us new opportunity. The other pathway that I think is very important today is perhaps not only related to opportunities. It's opportunities connected to challenges. And that's, of course, that we extract an enormous amount of materials from our beautiful planet every year. And we need to think through how are we transfer these materials into circular use so we don't need to tap out resources from our planet, because we're going to deplete our planet if we don't learn to. So those are the two pathways that sort of brings my attention to science still. Yeah.
So when you say circular in this aspect, you mean to make sure that we don't keep on extracting those raw materials from the earth, we can recycle?
Exactly. We extract some around 100 billion tons of materials from our planet every year. So that's basically 10 ton per every human being on our planet. And if we just make a circular technology or a material use of that, we don't need to extract. We can use all the materials we have extracted. I think we should reach a state, human kind, that now we have done it enough. We have enough of materials. Now it's just a matter of clever material design, engineering, business, society, and good politicians that can help us to guide us into a state where we actually are entirely circular. And I think that's definitely possible. I think I have been working with circularity now for a few years, and I'm more hopeful than ever. I think this is something we solve, and it's just a matter of hard work.
Much of your work involves polymers. And for listeners who are wondering, polymers are materials composed of very large molecules that are formed from repeating smaller chemical units, often like links in a chain. Now, Magnus, biology is quite good at making polymers, isn't it? Can we take lessons from biology?
Yeah, and this is a very interesting comment. I mean, if you look at the ribosomes of our cells, they are producing the most advanced polymers we can think of. All the proteins of our body are sort of templated by our DNA. And the ribosomes, that's the most advanced polymer factory you can ever think of. They are producing identical polymers, no dispersion, and they do exactly what they are programmed to do. It's amazing. So, of course, there's a great opportunity there. But there are also other, more bulk-generating pathways in biology. For instance, producing sugars. We have cellulose. We have lignin. Cellulose and lignin are the two most common polymers on our planet, organic polymers on our planet. So those are...
So just lignin, sorry, lignin is made by a lot of plants, predominantly it's in bark, is that right?
So cellulose is the fibers that are produced, let's say the high-performing fibers that are produced from plants. And then you have lignin, which is a more of a gel material that is also a very important part of the plants. And the cellulose fibers have been used in paper production and even for textiles in the past, but they have enormous possibilities in much more engineering technologies. And if you look at lignin, which has been considered as a byproduct of no use in industry, most of lignin today is burned. But if you look deep into the chemistry of lignin, you have phenols, you have fantastic alcohols in there that you can use for very advanced chemistry. So I think the two most common polymers on our planet coming from plants are representing fantastic sources for new materials for the future. Absolutely.
I'm really interested in what we might call the overall greenness of a material. So the material itself may not have been made from something that's sustainable, and the material itself may not be a wonderfully green material, but if it allows us to do other things that are particularly much better for the environment, then overall it might be that particular material is a good one to have. I mean, is there a way that we can measure the desirability of materials in that respect?
Absolutely. There are two measures that you can use. You can use the carbon dioxide payback time. And that is a measure of how much carbon dioxide do you generate when making this technology, and how long time does it take for this new energy technology to produce green energy to sort of pay back the carbon dioxide it has used. And if you look, and that is one way to look at it. And then you also have the energy payback time. How much energy does it take to produce a windmill or a solar cell, and how long time does it take to pay back that energy? So there are measures, and it's obvious that some technologies are preferred than others. If you take, for instance, growing trees, cut it down and burn it for energy, in our part of the world, it takes some 60 years to grow trees. Therefore, at least the carbon dioxide payback time is on the order of 6 years. However, solar cells and windmills are much shorter. So this is one way to measure, but it's not the only way. This is very important. There are also other criteria that needs to be included. And that is, for instance, what is the life cycle analysis of this technology? How easy is it by the end of the day when you need to recycle it? And some technologies are much easier to recycle than others. So these are, so there are, I would say, life cycle energy, life cycle analysis, carbon dioxide payback time, and energy payback time. There are at least three tools that you can use to get a, I wouldn't say a clear picture, but at least one picture of when you, and of course, as a material scientist, I need to be aware of this, because if I develop a material that is utterly efficient in solar cells, but it takes 100,000 times more energy to produce it, or if it's more hazardous, then I should question myself, is this good or bad?
Absolutely. What do you see as the main barriers at the moment to creating new materials that will basically help the world, save the planet?
I see one challenge among people like myself. I need to go back to the classroom and learn about sustainability. That was when I was educated, sustainability was not a major, let's say, field of competence. So people of my age, and even those that are younger, need to go back to class, and we need to learn about sustainability in many aspects. It can relate to energy technology, it can relate to circularity and also policy and so that is one barrier. So I need to see that the material scientist also needs to be educated. We need to be more aware of sustainability criteria. So that is one barrier. Then from the society point of view, I would see, of course, more investments from the society in recycling. I think that is the major problem. I think energy technology is a little bit ahead of circularity. If you take plastics, we in Sweden we collect some several 10% of the plastics, but in the end, by the end of the day, only 1 or 2% of all these plastics are actually recycled. We either burn them, or they are just landfill. It's really a very depressing state right now. So I think we can do much better. So if I look at energy technology, for instance, a fuel cell or an electrolyzer to produce hydrogen, the efficiency of electrolyzers today is around 90%. Fuel cell is around 40%. But the efficiency of humankind is down to 1-2% for recycling plastic. So I think it's our behavior, and also the pressure from politics needs to elevate considerably. And I think if we would have this discussion in 10 years from now, Helen, I would be happy if we could say that, okay, we are now up to 50 or maybe 90% of circulating plastics. But that is just a shocking news to many people when you start to dig into these numbers. It's a tragedy right now.
Actually, I'm tempted to make a note of the date, and I'll contact you again in 10 years, and let's hope we can have smiles on our faces then.
And then we can say we can check the box. It's done. That would be fantastic, because we have something to do there. That's a really depressing data that bounces into your face when you read about it.
I'll be back with Magnus shortly. I've also been talking with José Videira, co-founder and chief executive of Symbiosis, which is a deep tech startup developing an artificial intelligence software that rapidly accelerates the validation of advanced materials and manufacturing processes from decades to days. José also lectures and coaches students at Imperial College London in entrepreneurship and how better to address emerging threats and security challenges. So, José, how would you say artificial intelligence is changing the way that scientists and engineers are developing new materials?
Humans are very good at recognizing patterns. The reason why we value manufacturing operators, people that have worked on a steel mill for 30 years, the reason why they're valued is because they've honed this pattern recognition algorithm in their brains, so that they have a feeling of how this machine is going to behave if they turn a dial. And this is very good up to a point with, so people are very good at looking at four or five different parameters working in complex and nonlinear ways. When you're looking at something as complex as a new alloy of a material, those parameters go from four to five up to tens or hundreds. And to establish patterns in that becomes overwhelming to the point of being completely unable to establish that pattern as a human. So that's where AI can come in. We have all of these possibilities, some of them with more confidence than other, right? So some in some parameter space, there's hypotheses we could get some materials. In other parameter spaces, there's evidence because people have created those materials. But then how do you link between those different bodies of knowledge to establish those patterns? That's where AI can come in to kind of pick out that pattern for, all right, I have a requirement, I need this material to behave in this different way. And we have this data set to say, this material did this, this other material did that. And we've also done some simulations on a hypothetical material over there 2 years ago. So maybe somewhere in the middle of these three, there's your ideal material. Give it a shot. AI is incredibly exciting, but we need to understand where and when it should be used. AI isn't a golden bullet. It will not solve everything. AI at the end of the day is just curve fitting. You can fit a curve to noise. What we have to establish first is whether the data is good enough to then leverage AI over. That's the hard bit that we as an engineering community need to figure out. But once we've figured that out, AI can then really transform engineering.
And now let's go back to Magnus Bythurian. Does intellectual property play a role in any of this?
Absolutely. Intellectual property rights, patents is very important. And I think I also see an evolution in the right direction also here. I think we scientists are also aware of that we need to secure rights so that we can explore our inventions in the future. And that's one opportunity. But I also praise another fact, being a scientist. I have been trained all my life to make science. I've been paid by fantastic, my project have been paid by fantastic foundations and by the governments and also by EU. And we have been trained to derive science and give away the information and knowledge for free. And I like that. I like to be a scientist. But at the same time, it's very important to secure inventions. So when someone comes to you, contact me and say, okay, can we develop this? And then we find out that no, we have no rights to do it. And then that's, of course, a shame, particularly within the area of sustainability. So the solution to this is try to do both. Try to both focus on publish and give away the information, but at the same time taking patents. So the tradition in my lab has always been to let's take a patent quick so we can also publish quick. So we always try to do that. And we, I don't know, I don't keep track of the numbers, but we have 100 or even hundreds of patents from my lab over the years. And that is, and I'm of course involved in only a fraction of those, but if I look at the whole lab, we are around 140 people today. So this is more of a tradition today. When I was a student, this was an exotic adventure to take a patent. But today it's a tradition, and it also helps us scientists to deliver something that can be commercialized in the end.
And there are other emerging technologies. I'm thinking of stuff like robotics, for instance. Does that help you in your new materials work?
Absolutely. And I see robotics, and I would say intelligent robotics, pops up here and there. Just over the last couple of weeks, it's interesting, Helen, that you bring it up. I was in one discussion, and it related to circularity, and I was discussing with scientists from Stockholm, and we said that one of the major challenges with the circularity is that we make products that are very complex, and they are including composites. And one important thing is how do we tear the components apart to recycle or reuse? And there probably very intelligent robots are needed that are driven by an AI protocol that identify and basically tear parts apart from each other. So, because composites and the fact that we have plastics, we have paints, we have metals that are sort of molded together, or they are basically adhered to each other in a way that it's very hard to get them apart. But maybe super intelligent robotics can aid us in just taking pieces apart to improve circularity.
I'm starting to get a bit of a picture of Magnus the scientist and the these various ways. I was originally thinking, you know, printed electronics and bioelectronics. And although, yes, it's all to do with electrons and ions and conduction, they just seem to me to be quite different. But actually, I can now start to see how, yes, you're using polymers and conductivity and biology and even paper and printed stuff. I mean, how does that, the printed stuff, link with the polymers?
Yeah, before jumping into this, you were touching on your, so the question is, how can biology and traditional electronics communicate with each other? And you said one word which I need to comment, and that is the polymer. So the polymer, if you can make polymer electronically conducting, you have a system that, which is very unique in contrast to silicon and metals. That is that if my arm here is the polymer, I can conduct electrons along the polymer, but I can conduct ions around it. And this is then ending up, so polymers in itself is actually intrinsically a mixed ion electron conductor. And ions are used in biology, and electrons are used in technology. So polymers becomes a natural interface to communicate between biology and electronics. Then jumping to printed electronics, polymers also has a unique feature, and that is that if you have the polymer chain again, and if you decorate with side groups, you can control solubility. So if I, for instance, have a dipole polar component as a side group, then you can dissolve it in water, and if I have a non-polar group, then I can dissolve it in organic solvents. So if you can dissolve the polymer in water or alcohols, you can then start to think of having these electronic materials as an ink. It's become an ink solution. And then some 2 decades ago, we started to think, okay, if you have an ink solution, that is an electronic material, and all you need to make electronics is you need a conductor, semiconductor, and an insulator. If you have that or good performance, you can make it all. You can make all wonderful electronic devices you can think of. So 20 years ago, my lab, or my small research group at that time, and many other labs around the world started to pour these inks to printing machines. And then we figure out, hey, the graphic art technology that has been developed over hundreds of years, starting with famous printing machines from, for instance, from Germany and so on, could we use those as manufacturing tools also for electronics? And then this evolved over the years, and today printing technologies are used heavily in industry all around the world in components that we use on a daily basis. And also we have developed many different techniques to print displays, sensors, and so on and so forth, and which actually are used on the market today. So it's an amazing, it just happened that we could make an ink solution out of electronic materials. And as I said, you only need those three. If you pour, instead of having cyan, magenta, and yellow, you pour in semiconductor, conductor, and insulators, and you can print electronic. That was an amazing journey for lasting for more than 20 years. And we have more activity than ever in this area actually right now.
So you can use basically the same old printer. You don't need to do anything different with a printer.
Yes, wow. That is the, so we already, I think it's 15 years ago, we bought a label printer from Denmark. And we just saw that, well, this is it's an all-in-line, reel-to-reel manufacturing machine. And we put it in the basement because it was quite dirty. And we started to pour materials into this and out in the at the end station of the machine came displays. And we have now qualified this. And so this is the basis for one of the let's say, spinning out technologies from our lab, and which is on the market since five, six years ago. So it's out there.
And the applications of printing semiconductors or printing conductive polymer, what would you use it for?
So the shelf label, electronic shelf labels that you see in the shops today, they are to a large extent printed. You have printing tools for the screens that you are looking at right now. And if it's OLED technology, it's a combination of printing and you evaporate materials also. But it's out there. So it's basically a lot of Internet of Things technologies, antennas, and so on and so forth, use small components, or the entire end product is manufactured through printing. And just from our labs, we have around 10 companies at various stages in maturity exploring more or less printed electronic devices towards Internet of Things or energy applications, and also medtech to some extent.
Tell me a bit more about the biological systems and the use of conductive polymers in biological systems. How are they going to be used, and how do they work?
Yeah, so since more than 15 years, we have developed devices that can basically used at the very interface. And if you take the pacemaker that has been around for many, many decades today, it's basically an electrical signal applied to the peripheral nerves of the heart, and you can generate nerve responses and then muscular responses in the end. If you take the brain, you can use similar technology, for instance, to combat tremors from Parkinson patients. And these technologies, both as a pacemaker and also deep brain stimulating electrodes, are doing fantastically. Then if you would like to become more specific, just electrical signals are not enough. And if you look at the signaling entities of our brain, it's ions. You have potassium, sodium channels going back and forth in the axons and to transport the signal, and then at the synaptic gap, you have neurotransmitters. So then we started to think: can we deliver the ions? Can we deliver the neurotransmitters based on an electric addressing signal? So we started to develop a device that translates an electronic signal into delivery of neurotransmitters, and we call this device an organic electronic ion pump. And this technology was developed, and we have used it in animal models to combat neuropathic pain, so basic chronic pain, and we have also explored it in brain tissue and so on. But all these devices have a limitation. They are manufactured on a substrate, so we need a planar substrate. And if we want to stick it into the brain, it basically produces a huge scar. So even though it's flexible inside the brain, you have a lot of scar. You have a glia cell formation around it. So you lose the efficacy of the device, and you produce scar tissue in the brain, which is, of course, bad. So we started to think along the lines: can we manufacture electronics into the brain? So that has been a tremendous activity over the last 5 years or three to five years in my lab. Can we manufacture electronics without any substrates in the brain? So that is what we are working with right now.
So you're using the chemicals that we have in our own brains to actually make the materials in situ, in vivo?
Exactly. So we just dispense from a syringe a cocktail of materials, and we made a long, like a Christmas wish list. What kind of features and characteristics would we like to have from this? And it should be dispensed from water or an aqueous solution. It should be no toxic components. It should have a gel structure in the end that mimics the plasticity or Young's module of the brain. It should integrate into the neural tissue, so you get a seamless interface. The main problem we had was that to dispense this and to make the materials distribute, you cannot have polymers because they are large molecules. They don't transport that far. So then we had the problem. So the electronic monomers, how do we polymerize those in vivo in the brain, for instance, or in the spine? And then we started to think, so you can do electropolymerization, you can do chemical polymerizations, but all these protocols are toxic. The brain doesn't like it. You damage the brain. And so then we started to look at what materials are available in the brain tissue or within mammalians and other animals. And you have a lot of sugar. So we developed a protocol, an enzymatic protocol that use the sugar and convert it finally into chemicals that then trigger other enzymes to aid polymerization. So we use the metabolites or the sugars of the naturally available in the animal or finally, hopefully, in humans to manufacture our electronics. And that was an amazing discovery and also sensation in the end when we realized that this was possible to use the energy system of the animal to power up manufacturing of electronics inside inside brain tissue. That was an amazing achievement, and I have, of course, extremely talented PhD students and postdocs that have done all the work on this, and it's an amazing achievement they have done.
How do you see the future of new materials progressing? I mean, do you see it being sort of perhaps more biologically driven than it has traditionally been?
I think to make us sustainable, I think that there needs to be a seamless integration of, let's say, engineering materials and biology in general. I see that we also need to think through also the biology protocols that are available out there to also decompose electronics. I wish in the future that we can throw our electronics in the first step, maybe in the paper and plastic recycling bin. And we have a battery product and also a company where the main benefit of those batteries is that they can be easily recycled using standard protocol. Maybe not too far future, instead of throwing electronics in the recycling bin for paper and plastics, it would be nice if you could throw it in the recycling bin for biological materials so you can decompose it. And I see tremendous activity around the world, but also in the WISE program, in this Wallenberg Initiative Material Science for Sustainability, where scientists come up with beautiful ideas how to use enzymatic protocols to decompose electronic materials. And that would be an amazing, let's say, next step. And then we saw not only the production of materials are sort of integrated with biology, but also the end-of-life story for highly advanced technologies are also sort of merged with biology, because biology can learn us a lot on how to make a perfect cycle. It has been, after all, a perfect cycle for many millions of years.
Whenever I'm asked, you know, what's the point of going into space? I mean, one of my answers is often around development of new materials and certainly the experimental value of working in orbit in weightless conditions. If you could do an experiment in space, what would it be?
I would see how we can grow these self-grown materials that we develop right now. It would be nice to see how they grow in space under complete zero gravity conditions. Do they form dendritic systems? It's very hard to do it. You can, of course, grow it in solutions, but it would be nice to see. Zero gravity, of course, would be very interesting. But in general, the research connected to space, the space journey in itself has a great value. I mean, we are humans. We are striving for new understanding, which is very important. But also the space science is a very good, and you have to understand me correctly here, it's like a fantastic playground for extreme ideas. That is what and I think it pushes the limit. And very often you can actually bring back some of these new achievements and project it down somewhere completely different applications where it does a lot of fantastic things. I mean, there are many material science achievements that have been done because you are pushing the limits so far that you have to do when you go to space. So I think the space research is definitely justified.
Magnus, thank you. It's been a wonderful discussion. Absolutely fascinating to hear your take on new materials, the creative ways you're finding to make them, what new materials might do for us and the planet in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helena. Thank you for reaching out and for your interest in our science. Very much appreciate it. And I just want to say that please don't forget we have a meeting planned for 10 years and then we will celebrate the fact that we are almost solved the circularity problem with plastics. So I will mark it in my calendar.
And it's in my calendar now.
Perfect.
Magnus talked about how new materials affect the way we work towards sustainability. Now, how we design new materials with sustainability as a goal, as well as recycling what we've already taken from the earth and using byproducts from other processes to make the new materials themselves. Electrically conductive, flexible materials can be printed or even made inside a living organism. And he looks forward to a future where electronics can be recycled along with other organic items like paper. And thank you for joining us on this podcast discussion. Do listen in to the upcoming episode of Zero Pressure Podcast next month, which will be about microelectronics and the quest for ever smaller, more powerful chips. What are the latest developments in chip technology, and why is geopolitics such a big deal where advanced chips are concerned? Please share the podcast, leave a review, and tune in next time. In the meantime, I leave you with this thought from Vincent van Gogh. Great things are done by a series of small things brought together.